Sometimes the cost is dear. Being complete, knowing defeat, keeping on from year to year. It takes some doing, monkering's the blues you hear, keeping on from year to year. Lest you're a fool, but the learning brings you pain. Knowing at once you're just a dunce, trial and error, loss and gain. Slow train, trial and error, loss and gain.
That's good, good music. That's Carmen McRae, the great Carmen McRae, with Blue Monk, and Clifford Jordan on tenor sax, Eric Gunnison on piano, George Mraz on bass, and Al Foster on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and it's Tuesday, April the 2nd. And a program I hope you will participate vigorously in, because it is something that I think we need to get to, and that is the idea of identity politics. We're going to be talking about identity politics, power, and post-racial America. Now, what occasioned this topic was, of course, we've been exposed to a lot of identity politics lately, except it is not coming across as that. It's coming across as constituencies making their point, and that is valid, that is fine, that's great. But you get a sense that all sides seem to be agreeing these days that the root problem in America, and I refer to racism, the root problem in America simply has just taken, you know, it's off in the Netherlands somewhere. It's off in the periphery. It's no longer central to critical questions of the day. And therefore, the question is, have we, in fact, come to the point where America no longer chooses to discuss race, no longer chooses to acknowledge racism as the fundamental flaw? In fact, I got a note not too long ago saying the issue isn't so much race anymore. It's more class. And my counter to that was, I have never seen a situation where people tackle the issue of inequity just on the basis of class except when they're dodging the issue of race. You dodge the issue of race and you talk class. And even so, you fail to recognize the connection between the two. It is as if there is a tacit agreement that we have overcome. We have overcome. The reality is we are overcome. We haven't overcome. We are overcome. So this is the question. Is identity politics today a valid strategy still? Does it still remain a valid strategy for empowerment? Does it threaten the possibility of coalition building? And why is it that so many people are thinking these days that it is simply a throwback to the old days, and we are now in a new day of forward-thinking social and political action and activism? Race doesn't quite matter as much anymore. There are other factors that have superseded race in importance. And yet, I see it as a structural and permanent issue. We haven't dealt with it. And I raise it because, you know, I expect this kind of thinking in more conservative quarters. But it is happening in progressive communities, liberal communities, and even the very communities that used to understand that their social and political and economic issues are deeply rooted in the question of race. So has racism really disappeared? Is it more class struggle? If not, then why do we get the constant reminder? If you've been looking at the news lately, constant reminder that there's something else that takes precedence. Now, this is not to suggest that any other issue must be secondary to race. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that in situations where clearly there is a racial element to it, there's also a reluctance. In fact, I would use the word resistance, a resistance to acknowledging it and dealing with it. And the progressive community is specifically guilty of this, I think. Afraid to confront race. Afraid to deal with it. So, your thoughts, we're going to get into this discussion. Of course, we always approach discussions with very, very deep respect for each other's views. But I'm interested in how you are seeing this phenomenon that is occurring. Maybe I'm out of step. Maybe I'm just seeing things. But that is what I see. I can't get over it. Even in the African-American community, there's a pervasive view that the issue is, we talked about that, the middle class. The president is convinced it's about the middle class. And to my mind, that's about two black people. I only know about two black people who qualify. So what is this yearning? What is this insistence on ignoring race when that is the very thing that we should be tackling? Because, we have had ample instruction that the basis on which one is oppressed is the basis on which one organizes. And we see that all the time. We see it in the gay struggle right now for marriage equality. We see it in the immigration issue. the basis on which you, you know, you have that much skin in the game, that's the basis on which you organize. So is it out of place now? Should we move on, get over it, and lift ourselves out of the morass of being saddled with racial issues and get on with life? Because things have changed. This is post-racial America. And we better get hip. We better get in tune that the landscape has changed. Therefore, the discussion should change. Therefore, the issues should change. And we're getting that from the president himself. 888-874-4888. I'm interested in how, because I am imagining that people listening to this program, people listening to PRN, would describe themselves as, you know, left of center, progressive, liberal in the good sense. But we all are saddled with this thing. It seems to embarrass people when we talk about race. I get that sense very often. And especially when I talk with friends from the progressive community, they say, you know, it's gender issues now. It's everything else except this racial issue. We have to move beyond it. And therefore, we disguise the problem. We disguise it as something else in order to deal with it, but we're not dealing with it. 888-874-4888. Identity politics, power, and post-racial America. How do we reconcile all of these things? What is the struggle now? If it is to be that we ignore race, or that we see something larger than race as being the immediate issue, and so we have a balkanization of effort. In the current climate that exists, where people now will be scrambling and retreating to their own little corner of the world, because that is where they draw their strength? Or are we going to see groups attempting to sap the political energy of others to make a case for their cause, but they're not interested in reciprocating? Or some people downright just believe that enough already. Get over this racial thing. It is you people who are talking about race. You are the people who are perpetuating this thing. We have made significant strides. We have seen a lot of forward movement. There's a lot of progress made. Why can't you let this thing go? Why can't you see the broader picture? And when I answer, and I tell them what I see as the broader picture. The broader picture is always, let us use your muscle. Let us use your fuel to bolster our argument. And we will move on. So progressives have some internal things to take care of, some internal contradictions, I think. How pervasive is it, do you believe, that this notion is in the progressive community or in general in the United States? The feeling that politically, and we're talking today as political people, okay? We're talking politics here. The pragmatic business of politics, which is, you know, forming alliances, tapping into a power base, constructing a power base, and basically using the power base to extract concessions from a very unwilling and truculent system. Frank from Maryland, thank you for joining us.
Carolyn Patrice, a great subject, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. What is your view?
Well, my view is this. I was talking, and I had the fortune of an educator, and I worked with the Close Up Foundation, which is a civic education organization. I had a conversation with young kids who are now adults, and their biggest thing is wanting to get beyond race, is wanting to get beyond it. You know, we're not our parents' children, you know, that whole thing. That was a very strong thing that I saw in young conservative white kids. And what I see happening now, I mean, I just got off on Facebook having a conversation I often have with my conservative friends. And we were talking about this congressman, Don, whatever his name is, who made the wetback comment. Obviously racist. Obviously racist. And this guy could not see beyond, when I posted something about it, he couldn't see beyond the source that I got it from. So for him, it's more important, the source that I got it from, than that this man said something so blatantly racist. And I had to correct him on that. But it seems to be a big thing with even a new generation of people, that they want to erase their connection to people in their past of their race who did this. It's like a guilt thing they want to shake off their back. Well, I had nothing to do with that. It's over. Why don't you get over it? That's the mentality. And I liken when I said it was, it's like if somebody got raped, and the rape is, and of course this is not the same thing, I'm just bringing this as an example. It's if somebody got raped, and then the rapist tells the rape, get over it. When you're still feeling and dealing with the destruction that incident caused in your life, and in this case, minorities, particularly blacks, but minorities who experience these things are being told, get over it, it's no longer an issue, it's no longer, and it's like, no, it's wrong. It is an issue. And race is still an issue by the number of racist things that have come out of the Tea Party these days, which as far as I'm concerned, they're just another wing of Confederates. They believe in the Confederacy, they believe in the Articles of Confederation, and they carry themselves as such. And you find lots of racists in that organization.
But Frank, so I have to ask you this. I want to ask you this. In the progressive world, let's just say, you've talked about the Tea Party people, you've talked about conservatives. Mm-hmm. You haven't talked about the reaction that you get in the progressive world around this issue of race, and whether there is a comfort level or a discomfort level when this issue surfaces.
Well, I find that it's the same dynamic. With the conservatives, it's more so because they feel like, you know, I think that they understand, they see the evidence that is still going on, but for liberals or progressives, they see it as we're past that. And they still feel that guilt. That guilt, that music, that white guilt is still there. Even for somebody who feels that, well, I'm past that. I see things in a colorblind way. But that guilt is still there. Those things still happen. And so whenever race is brought up, there is a reaction, a direct reaction to it on either side. One side doesn't want to deal with it at all. The other side wants to totally deny that it's happened.
So if you were to write a prescription here in terms of, because if we are to continue this issue of pragmatic politics, which is going to involve at some point or the other, coalition building is going to involve having to deal with each other's issues, if it comes to that, for example, that is how Barack Obama got elected. People got over a whole bunch of hurdles, as they did for Jesse Jackson. When Jesse Jackson was running, that was what the Rainbow Coalition seemed to signify, that people can get over the hurdles that historically have interrupted some kind of continuity in relationships, political relationships, with these various constituencies. So what is the work that has to be done to bridge this gap?
That's interesting. I think it definitely deals with education. I mean, some of it's going to deal with, as my father would say, the old people dying and moving on, and a younger, more educated group of people coming to the fore. And, you know, in my time as an educator, I've seen some of that. You know, kids these days don't relate to race the same way we did. You know, and if there is change happening, and it's coming from the standpoint of education, but from the standpoint of those who are there, it's still about education. It's still about, you know, this guy who said these things, you know, John, I forgot what his name is, John
Me
Jones,
too.
Whatever.
I forgot his name, right.
he has no education about it because he didn't even see that anything he said was wrong. He had to be forced to apologize for saying something that blatantly racist because he didn't see anything wrong with it. So there's an education, there's a learning curve there, and I think that we have to take make all these things teachable moments. And if we do not make them a teachable moment, they will continue to happen in this generation. They will continue to, because of good. There are a lot of people who are doing these racist things, who are saying these racist things, who won't even acknowledge that it is racist. That's their education curve. Now, again, I do think that a lot of these people are going to die out, and through that just matriculation part process, it's going to get better. But in the meantime, there has to be an educational impetus where people talk about this and are educated about what racism is, what the effects are, the history behind it, which I find a lot of Americans are totally ignorant to their own history. They act as if today is what's happening and that's it. No, it's built on a history. And they don't understand that. And civics is not being taught in school. And that's, again, why people can be told total lies by the media and believe it, because they do not have the education that even my father had.
Well, thank you, Frank. I see why you probably are a very good teacher. Thanks so much for joining us today and contributing. 888-874-4888. Richard from Nebraska. Thank you, sir, for being with us today.
Yes, I'd like to build on just what was said. I came of age in the 60s in California, moved to D.C. During the Watergate years, spent 15 years in New York City, and have been 26 years in Nebraska, about 21 on an Indian reservation. So I, from Watts riots to being on, or rebellion, I should say, being on an Indian reservation, I have an interesting perspective on race, economics, gender, and the class. I happen to think that the gentleman speaking about being rooted in history is extremely important. Back in the 70s, the editor of Ebony magazine at the time pointed out how descendants from the indentured servants of the eight Negro, I'm using the term at the time, indentured servants at Jamestown in two generations. A few of they had grown into several families. They were free by 1640, and in another two generations, a few of those individuals participated in the slave trade, the African slave trade. And because of the relationship between freedmen and slaves, we had the development of the Negro class, the separate but equal that the 1890 Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court decision ruled on the basis of the black class being separate but equal, which was, of course, was overturned with the Brown versus Board of Education 1854. And in my view, the election of Obama in 2008 demonstrates the vindication of the black class in the economic sense, that it was very, very significant and important, as we all recognize in Obama's election. But we see in the most recent biography of Rosa Parks, the Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks by Jean Theo Harris, which I just read. It was published at the end of January of this year, addresses this problem of a lack of comprehension of history, as I've just related it very briefly, in even the black experience of America. It points out that Mrs. Parks, who was her grandfather was active in Marcus Garvey, and she went to the Highlander School in 1955, a few months before her historic experience in Montgomery, Alabama. But she was not recognized nor allowed the role that she otherwise could have had in the modern civil rights movement had she not been a product of her generation, because even with this sense of rebellion, both before and after December 1st, 1955, she still was looked upon as a demure, a quiet woman of courage, because that's how she was brought up in that generation of being a Southern black working class woman. And Mrs. Theo Harris's biography points out how the black class of Montgomery, as well as the black class of the civil rights movement, looking at how the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP was a conservative chapter relative to some of the other aspects of the NAACP, some of the other chapters. And of course, the NAACP itself was considered a more moderate or conservative group than, let's say, the Union of Sleeping Porters.
Richard, I must ask you, because you've referenced it a couple of times.
Yes.
What do you mean by the black class?
The black class is similar to the upper class of white people. For example, the black class is, in today's time, is Michelle Rees and Bill Cosby and several other black people who sit on the board of directors of Michelle Rees's advocacy of charter schools in order to address the problems of public schools. And that adopts a segment of the white man's agenda in the 21st century that I think is counterproductive in terms of really looking at the problems of elementary and secondary education, both public and private. So by black class, I mean, Mr. Johnson, of Chicago, and Oprah, and they have succeeded in this capitalist world. It's not that they aren't giving back to their communities in their own way, but what I'm basically trying to say is that from our colonial era, the freedmen back in the 70s, there were wealthy black men in Philadelphia, in New York, in Boston,
sure,
who couldn't vote and perhaps were socially segregated, but on an economic level were at the same level of black people. And so I'm looking at it primarily as an economic determination as opposed to social or cultural
okay.
determination.
Okay, I understand that.
Yes.
How do you account? Do you see today any evidence, especially now we're talking about the progressive community, do you see any evidence that the progressive community as a whole has dealt straightforwardly and healthily And I'm talking about blacks and whites and Latinos, whoever is in this group called the progressive community. Is there a healthy dialogue, a healthy understanding of the obstacles that race poses?
Well, I think we have to broaden the issue to the circumstances of just race. The gentleman before you said something extremely important, which I think affects
all Frank.
People.
Frank from Maryland, yes.
Okay, yes. Which was the addressing the issue of multi-generational trauma. That is something among the indigenous communities of the world that we don't have a real grasp on. And in terms of answering your question in a contemporary sense, yes, I do think there are pockets in every country, you know, in every culture of the world where, yes, the young people are, you know, complex. This is a very complex issue now. We can't separate it in terms of ideology or economic models or social models. We have to look at both holistically as well as microlistically. That's why I believe very much that the real action is always at the local level, and we have to build on the local level, to the regional level, to the state level, to the domestic level, to the national level, to the international level, in order to really address this problem. But I do think that the overall discussion is really very, very confusing and very, very difficult to get a handle on. So it's mixed.
All right. Well, thank you so very much, Richard. You've contributed very, very generously to the discussion today. Thank you so much. James from Queens, let's hear from you.
Good afternoon, Ms. Scott.
Good afternoon.
The issue of this issue of race, number one, it's not defined what it is. It's nationalities, because number one, you have the United Nations. Every nation is represented by a flag, a language, and a culture. For some reason, the black folks in America have been demonized and been put into a point of being, well, you don't represent anything. But yet, they're able to, Caucasian people are able to make money off the blacks that have been brought over here, been stripped of their culture, stripped of their language, stripped of what dignity they had. But yet, millions of dollars have been profited off these people, and all of a sudden, when it comes to gaining whatever upward mobility or what's owed to me, well, that's nothing. You're not going to get that, and it's
but
not going to be that way.
I appreciate your point. However, I would like, if you can, bring this into focus a bit tighter. Let me just give you a little guideline here. Your historical perspective, I appreciate, and I see where you're going. How do you believe today that people who would you would say are progressive, and I'm talking about just people across the board, because we do see among the very people who are oppressed the attitude that they have gotten over it as well. Let's do something else. Let's get on with business. You know, let's get on with life. We have overcome. How do you see this being played out in so many ways on the national scene, where we have groups of people who are definitely driving the issues that concern them. And we are, you know, as I said before, we are balkanized. We have this group over here doing this and this group over there doing that. But we're not seeing, by now I'm expecting, maybe I'm overambitious, but I was expecting to see a healthy distribution, you know, and people would be able to embolden those communities that historically have been weak in getting the goodies that they deserve. But I'm not seeing that very much.
Well, you're not going to see that because, number one, the people that come here only look for only one thing, and that is money. The streets are paved with gold.
So when you say the people who come here, who would those be?
Well, you got all these people that have been brought over here. Mostly your people that look Caucasian are allowed to come to this country. and have the same sort of mindset. And the only thing they come here for is not the cultural exchange, not to say, well, okay, I want to get a life of my own. No, I come here to make money.
Well, yes, and you could appreciate that, can't you?
If that's what they want to do. You can appreciate it if it's done according to the laws. But for some reason, people become corrupt, they become docile, they become so brainwashed of the negativity of what this country represents, not the positive. I mean, you're given an expo of, well, look how great this is. Look how great this country is. Look at the money and everything. But when you begin to look at the morals and you look at the way people are acting, they're not acting according to what they're supposed to act. They're acting according to what the commercialization has put them out to be. So now they say, well, I should be a part of that foolishness instead of being part of the real thing. But those that are of the older generation would say, wait a minute, I don't want my children looking like that. I don't want them acting this way. And this goes through in the churches, in the politics, as well as in the schools. So now you have a war going on now in this society, the have and the have-nots. I recall when we had black folks had an area in Oklahoma called Black Wall Street.
Sure.
And black folks worked for themselves. They didn't ask the Caucasian for nothing. But the Caucasian people got so jealous of blacks having that mobility of coming together, they would start something of a racial attitude to cause that particular town to be burnt to the ground or a massacre.
Yes, we talked about that on this program, yes.
But in a sense, today, all the accomplishments that black folks have accomplished only at the gains of maybe some Caucasian people that felt sorry for them. But in the long run, we don't own anything. We don't own the schools. We don't own the hospital. We don't even make the food that we grow.
But, James, you've been very generous with the negatives. I get it. What is on the positive side, as you see it?
Positive side is we have to separate. The two nationalities, or you might call them races, cannot get along. They cannot occupy the same space or the same time.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
So there has to be a separation.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your contribution today. Michael from New Jersey, we're talking about identity politics, power, and post-racial America.
Yes, Eutrice, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
I'd like to get into this identity politics. I don't know if I understand it as you intended it to bring it out here, but it's I guess identity politics means who's doing what, I guess. And in one sense, something struck me. I was watching television, and I happened to be watching CNBC, whatever. And there's Chris Hayes is there, and he was talking about Obamacare, and he's saying, our citizens are suffering, so we need this. But I thought to myself, who is our citizens? I mean, who are you as a journalist saying our citizens? Aren't you also a citizen? So he saw himself as other than the people he was talking about, which is supposed to be everybody. And then I thought back to Obama's State of the Union address, where he brought out the term "we the people," and actually he used it very effectively. I don't know if you were impressed, but when he said "we the people," I almost had a little thrill, you know, that hey, we're all together, we the people. You know, there was also all of a sudden the divisions disappeared. But actually, his actions belie what he was saying because, you know, we the people, who are the people that are we the people? According to him, they're probably the corporations, they're Monsanto, the Defense Authorization, et cetera, the people that he does business with. But he masked that by saying we the people. Now, this is what I think of with identity politics. Who are you identifying with, all the people or a group against another group? And the fellow on television that said, our citizens, he obviously thought himself in a different class of people than he was talking about.
Well, you find that a lot in the media, where people assume to express the views of a group or a whole nation sometimes, sometimes the whole world.
But they themselves aren't part of it.
Well, what I mean by identity politics, we have constituencies that have been developed around sometimes their single issues, but I'm talking in terms of identity politics. We have race being a huge part of identity politics. Everybody recognizes it because whether they're Republican, Democrat, or Libertarian, conservative, they understand these pockets exist, and they are formidable, if well organized, as political entities, identity politics. I go back to the Jesse Jackson years of not too long ago, 1984, 1988, when the identities came together. We had the gay community backing him. We had Latinos. We had Asians. We had African Americans, of course. We had people who were in the union movement, people who strongly identified a single issue, but there was a strong correlation between the political issue and race, what we would typically understand as race. And they were able to get over all of these historical barriers to forming coalitions.
To work for a specific thing.
To work to elect Jesse Jackson, who then hijacked the movement and put it on his letterhead. But the thing is, do we have that anymore? Do we see the progressive, is a progressive movement or the progressive world actually being progressive when it excludes? I mean, I watch, and I gave up, I made a commitment to myself. I'm not going to watch any programs that are all white anymore. I'm just not going to do it.
That's a good idea.
I'm fed up with it. We had the president, vice president, remember when they were talking about the guns in Newtown and Biden was sent out there to talk about gun control measures and whatnot. And I remarked, how is it possible if you are so progressive and so liberal that you could talk about an issue like gun violence and have an almost totally white room? How is that possible?
These are the contradictions.
This is exactly what I'm talking about. So the progressive community, we have the feminist community doing the same thing. The insistence that it has to be white-led, and the whatever the unique issues are with respect to other constituencies, they don't have to recognize them or deal with them. The important thing is that they behave also like the old guard. You know, we absorb, you must listen to me, I'm in control, and we don't have very much room for black leadership, even in Cuba. All right, now here you have Fidel Castro and his brother, Raul, and for all the years that they've been in control, there is nobody black in Cuba.
Well, there's virile in my wife is Cuban, so I know a little bit about this.
You know this is amazing. Even the radicals can't
based
yeah,
on
even
color
the radicals
in Cuba.
Can't get rid of it.
No.
Even the radicals can't move away from it. In Cuba, where the revolution was started by Los Macheteros, the Africans of Cuba.
Absolutely true.
And they have no place in leadership in what would be conveyed to us as an extremely progressive a regime.
Well, you know, it's like the contradictions become so glaring, and the division of the contradiction so much that it becomes totally imbalanced and sort of insane in a sense.
So, when Michael, what is your prescription for a mature relationship with each other with respect to, let's say I'm an African American, I have particular issues relating to the historical memory of the people who look like me and so forth. I understand that. Why is that necessarily a threat? Why can't that just simply be, I accept that, and we work with it toward a common goal?
Well, I hate to say should be, but that would be normalized. That would be as it should be. But the thing is, we become idealistic and we become confused with our own intentions of our idealism. And anytime you have idealism, there is going to be a contradiction, because there's what is and what should be. And the gap between what is and what should be is never going to be bridged. It's got to be bridged with a lie, with an inaccuracy, because what is actually is, and what should be doesn't exist. So you have something that exists, something that doesn't exist fighting something that exists. Racism exists. Racial differences, etc., exist, but we have idealism that we should be over that. You know, here we have a black president, we should be beyond racism. So that's an idealism.
Yeah.
It doesn't really exist, but it causes a tremendous... So I don't want to take up too much of time, but maybe other people can comment on that.
Thank you so much, Michael, for your contribution. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye.
888-874-4888. This is a very good discussion. And I'm glad that it's, you know, we feeling reasonably comfortable exchanging points of view. One of the things that has happened, of course, is that people think if you are pro something, you are necessarily anti something else. To be pro-Latino, to be pro-black is to be anti-white. It's not like that at all. The question is, do people have the maturity to accept that? That you can be pro yourself and deal with each other on a mature level, accepting the realities that I state as being important to me? That is the challenge. Even in the progressive community, like I just commented about Fidel Castro, even there, there is no room. They did not have room to fully integrate the government in a country that is largely African in origin. Hello, you're on the air, Orville of New York.
Hello, Utrice.
Hello, sir.
I am... In terms of identity politics, and I think you were looking at, and with this conversation, and where you've been coming from, I think, for the past few months, is how do we look at where we are logically and honestly, and then create something that will be beneficial for us, and us meaning the different people, because you have different people. You have different classes. You have different races. You have different sexualities. I was going to say grades of sexuality and interlocking stuff. I wouldn't even go there. There are so many different types of people. And I think finding out roots that we all agree upon and can have consensus on and think it's very important, like maybe the environment, is one thing. But then again, I'm a black male, or I'm a male that is black. And I live in New York City. I'm from the Caribbean, and my genes, my look, my feel, my sound, everything, so much of me comes from Africa. And my sexuality is pretty much fluid. I do have a certain type of focus. And, you know, and so many of those things. But I think if you look, there was a gentleman who called and said, separate. And I think if some people actually feel that way, I'm wondering, how do they look at the situation, create a particular plan? And, of course, separation doesn't mean, it doesn't have to mean leaving the United States. It could be working within on another level. And how do, because I would do that personally, because I love everybody. And I like some people. And it's been 20 years I've arrived at it that we're not healed yet. whites are not healed, and blacks are not healed. Latinos are not healed. They have quote-unquote whites in there and also blacks. And I've seen the craziness that goes on there in the same one family. So how do we assess everything, look at it, work on things that we all think is vital, and then work on our own issues? And I think understanding that it's a sick situation, and you're not going to, I don't believe, get anything healthy out of sick individuals, whether they be black or whether they be white. And if I could find other people of like mind, I think we can all create something so beautiful. And I think a vehicle like yours is what I listen for and look for, to see how can I find some like minds who are analytical, who are logical, who are understanding or overstanding that we are not going to change everything. But how do we put some effective steps into place, a foundation, where the next generation and the ones afterwards will have a progressive way of taking care of themselves and interacting with society logically?
But I have a question for you, because you use the word foundation, and this is where I am. I'm still dealing with the foundational relationship between and among all folks. But the assumption still, even in the progressive community, I just talked about Castro, is a revolutionary who still cannot and still has not in 50 odd years been able to divest himself of the notion that blacks are capable of leadership and should be leading.
But I don't see that as a foundation. I see that as what it actually is. I respect what he's done in terms of, and his, you know, I respect the country.
I do.
Mm-hmm. But I also understand or overstand the racial part of it. Like you, you said the foundation of the movement itself there was, what was the grouping you named?
Macheteros.
Macheteros.
Uh-huh.
Even though the foundation of it there, you'll find that, I think, again, that people of color, black people, are the foundation of almost everything, even in this country, in terms of progressives, women's movement, everything, every gay movement, quote-unquote, everything that comes out of people moving ahead. You would think that people in our society would say, okay, let's make sure the Native Americans get something that's really, really quality. And the African Americans get something that's really, really quality, because that's common sense. Because how you treat the least, it's going to filter up. So I'm getting tongue-tied and all that. But your question again is the foundation. I do not see Castro, the movement in Castro, the beginning movements, but it's always usurped. I do not see it as a foundation of me and where I should be headed. I see it as something that's powerful, something that has something to teach, that is workable in terms of socialism, in terms of things like that. But I do understand that we have to separate to a certain degree, or some amongst us, so we can do what we need to do.
Thank you. But I still say, even within the ranks of the revolutionary groups, you still have this deep-seated, race-based way of thinking and an unwillingness to confront the contradiction.
That's his whole thing
about looking at contradictions.
Excuse me for doing this, but you know black folks with dark skin who have an issue, you know, a serious issue. So yeah. I don't expect it from them. I don't expect that from them. There's so much work and healing that needs to be done, that I do not expect that from. I don't expect that.
Well, thank you so much.
Excuse me for cutting you, please. I respect you so much, and I appreciate you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And I got an email from Nathaniel V. I would just use the last initial. He says it must be talked about intelligently. The ones who have advantages because of it don't want to talk to the disadvantaged about their differences. It is imperative that we talk about it. I hope that you thought that this program started that conversation in that direction and it was useful to you today. I urge you to tune in tomorrow. It's going to be a hellified program tomorrow. Tell your friends and be sure to tune in. Absolutely. Thank you, Frank and Richard, James, Michael, and Orville. Thank you so much for your substantive contributions today. Up next is Economic Update with Richard Wolff. And you can reach me on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead, and certainly at leadstories@gmail.com. See you tomorrow. Thank you so much. Measured by the dew.